Welcome to the Bully Pulpit from the University of Southern California Center for the Political Future. Our podcast brings together America's top politicians, journalists, academics, and strategists from across the political spectrum for discussions on hot-button issues where we respect each other and respect the truth. We hope you enjoy these conversations. All right, welcome everybody. This is an exciting one, the politics of electric vehicles. It's a year of big politics. Electric vehicles are a big thing. So on behalf of the USC Center for the Political Future here at University of Southern California, I'm excited. We're going to spend the next hour talking about something I care a lot about. I'm an old Detroit kid, and I became an EV nut like 2.5, 3 years ago. I like to joke my lifetime average is 5 miles per gallon, but I had the conversion. The physics are better. And I actually even started and bootstrapped evpolitics.org. And so I love talking about this stuff. And to join me, I got the two best in the business. First of all, from, I'm not sure if it's Zeta or Zeta, but it's the coolest association name there is, the Zero Emissions Transport Organization. We have Albert Gore, who runs it here. Welcome, Albert. Great to have you. And then, oh, no, it's our pleasure. And then I, I'm about to call it the Auto Alliance, and David, that's wrong. It's the Alliance for Auto Innovation, right? Because you guys have upped your name. We have David Sweetheart, who's their director of all policy matters, and they represent all those millions of auto jobs and auto companies that build just about anything with four wheels here. So, David, thank you and the folks at Alliance for Automotive Innovation for being part of this. All right, so what we're going to do is the EV Politics Project, we did a poll looking at the polarization between Republicans, Democrats, you know, basically political identification versus what people think of electric vehicles, because it has become a thing, and we're feeling it in the sales figures. So I wanted to spend about 10 minutes going through some of the data, and then we can discuss the whole waterfront here. So we're going to do the magic share screen button, and we're going to go to my incredibly, ridiculously messy desktop here, and boom, there we go. All right. So first of all, what we did was we polled Americans with a income of $50,000 a year or higher, and the reason we did that was we wanted to reach the entire new car market, and this will get us 99% of it. We lose about a third of the voters. So we have about two-thirds of the voters and all the car buyers. So we ask people what kind of car they drive. And we have actual registration statistics, and David's organization keeps good track of this. So there's a little bit of range to this. But fundamentally, 8% of people said they were electric car buyers. They had bought electric cars. And if you look, the partisan breakdown, 3% of Republicans told us that. And by electrics, we mean battery electrics and plug-in hybrids. 15% of Democrats. And in the great independent tradition, they're sitting there at 9%, a little closer to Democrats than Republicans, but in the middle. Now, when you wonder about the partisanship of people with an income of 50K, a household income and over, as you can see, which we kind of, that's our analog for the new car market, 40% Republican, 23 independent, 36 Democrat. So that's kind of who we talked to nationally, 600 people in a scientifically conducted poll. And then this is something that David sent me, which I thought was really interesting, how big the EV model availability is now. As of the last quarter of 23, 67 electric battery vehicles on the market, 45 plug-in hybrids, and 2 fuel cell vehicles for you real cutting-edge folks there, 114 total. So it's becoming a more and more mature market. Well, let's look at the politics of that market and what people say. We asked on the poll, what's your opinion of American car brands? And by the way, we asked German, Japanese, but we started with American. And among Republicans, about 59% of people said mostly favorable opinion. And only about 9% of Republicans said mostly unfavorable. Among Democrats, pretty much the same number. I believe it was 55 over 10. So no real partisan difference when you ask people their opinion of American car brands. But when you ask them about electric-only car brands, boom, here's the partisanship. Only 9% of Republicans rated those favorably. 49% said unfavorable. That's what we in the political consulting world call a net negative rating of 40 points. On the other hand, among Democrats, a lot of mixed, but still the ratio of favorable in the middle upper 30s to unfavorable around 20, nearly 2-1. So two different planets. So we asked people to put themselves in one of three categories. Are you seriously interested in buying an EV in the next year or two? Or you might buy an EV once all the problems are worked out and maybe the prices are a little lower, because right now they tend to exist in the more higher price of the market. Or 26%, I'll probably never buy an EV. 74% of Democrats score in that group that seriously interested, 40, the biggest number, or 39, and 35 might once the problems are worked out. 74 open to EVs is how we categorized them. Now, on Republicans, 56, bare majority, 17% interested in buying an EV in the next year or two, 39% might buy an EV once all the problems are worked out and prices are lower, and 44%, no way, nada, never going to buy, at least what they're thinking today, an EV. So again, pretty big difference, about 20 points. Then we asked one of my favorite questions, if you bought an EV, what would your best friends and relatives think about that? Your judgmental relatives. How many, you know, would say it's a smart move? Well, 61% of Democrats thought their friends and relatives would call it a smart move. Only 19% are Republicans, two different cultures. You're taking too big a risk with that thing. Republicans, 48, Democrats, 23. And you always look at the ratios here, 2-1. You spend too much money, you fool, 49% are Republicans, 29% of Democrats. And finally, I don't know about you, you're becoming too political. 18% of Republicans, 7% of Democrats. Fairly small numbers, but again, look at that ratio, 2.5-1. Real differences between the two groups. Then we ask people some agree or disagree questions. EVs are for people who see the world differently than I do. Agree or disagree? This is kind of the political loading of EVs. And over on the left with the frame around it, you can see the difference. Republicans, 59% agree with that. Only 25% of Democrats do. Among the disagreement, 75% of Democrats say, nope, they're not for people who see it differently than I do. 41% push back on the Republican side. And then there are a few other questions. If you look in the middle in that yellow frame, what's your view on climate change? If you say climate change is overhyped, not that serious a problem. It's 2-1, 65-35. You agree that EVs are for people who see the world differently than I do. On the other hand, if you think climate change is important and we have to help the environment and EVs can be part of that, 70-18. So environmental views of climate change and what to do about it and the seriousness of the problem is a massive driver of the difference. And then finally, you can kind of see the difference between younger and older males there. And all the way over, I think one of the big findings we got was if you say you have friends or relatives who own an EV, you're 62% you disagree. Well, if you have no EV friends, it's much closer, 49-51, with 49 agreeing that EVs are for people different. So this is a clear case of try them and you like them. People talk them up to their friends, but there's work to be done. And then finally, and we have kind of a fun question after this, and we'll be done with the slides. Agree or disagree? EVs are the future, and one day I will probably drive one. 56% of everybody agreed with that. 44% disagreed. And again, these are the car market, people with a household income of $50,000 or higher. Among Republicans, 12 points underwater, 44 agree, 56 agree. So clearly a Republican problem, but they're only 6 points away from half. 44 is a pretty big chunk out of 100. There's hope there. Among Democrats, it's a done deal. 72% agree EVs are the future, and one day I'll probably drive one. Only 28% are disagreeing. Among voters of color, minority voters, it's 73-27. Even among people all the way over to the right, and I'll wiggle the cursor around here, who say, when we asked them the biggest problems, which were price and range and worry about charging, among people who say limited range, charging worry is the biggest problem, still 75% say, I'll probably drive one. That's going to get fixed. There's some optimism there. And then finally, look at pickup truck drivers, by the way, 54 over 46, a little tougher segment. And then finally, often in rural areas, longer range towing needs. Finally, over here on the right, if you try it, you like it. If you have friends with an EV, 74% agree they're the future and I'll probably drive one. If you have no friends, you're one of the worst numbers in the survey on this. 58% disagree. So any auto dealers in your car store, let people take them for a day and play with them, because they do work that way and there's something to overcome. We asked people the best reasons to own an EV. And again, on most of this, Republicans, Democrats, and Independents look the same. Never paying for gasoline again. Big with Republicans, Democrats. Even 44% of people highly favorable of Donald Trump say that. Rebate from the government. This is also fascinating because you can go to some conservative think tanks and they tell you, oh, people hate subsidies. Well, it turns out Republicans are just fine taking a check from the government. They actually rate it a little higher than Democrats do, with 27%, one of four, almost one of three, putting that in their top two reasons. Well, 23% of Democrats, Independents like it too. Big difference is the environment, the second line. 33% of Republicans put good for the environment in their top two. Well, 60% of Democrats do, and it's the number one attribute with Democrats. It's also the biggest polarizing issue. And then finally, we had a little fun. We asked people to agree or disagree. Elon Musk is a good ambassador for electric vehicles. Among Democrats, 34% agreed and 66% disagreed. And this is political polarization, a really clear indicator of it. Among Republicans, who tend to be more hostile, as we've seen, to EVs, 61% said that Elon is a great ambassador, a good ambassador for EVs. Now, this means that Elon Musk could help a lot with Republican EV attitudes should he put that weight down that he has, that image. On the other hand, I'm sure the Tesla marketing people are hoping Elon takes a round-the-world cruise for a while, because it's a little bit of a headwind for them. Same thing among people when we asked them, if you say climate change is a serious problem, you disagree that Elon's a good ambassador for electric vehicles by 58 to 42. If you think climate change is overhyped, which is a group less interested, significantly less interested in EVs, 2-1, yeah, he's a good ambassador. So there's an opportunity for Elon here, but also some headwinds. So that is a quick look at polarized America on EVs. So now, panel, all you've got to do is solve the problem. So I'm going to go to David first, because you guys at the Alliance really track data. You track the market. Your members are people who make the cars or make the components. What is the state of the EV market today? I keep hearing media reports about it slowing down, it's dying, et cetera, et cetera. What's the reality of the electric vehicle market in America for light duty?
Well, thanks so much, Mike. And by way of background, knowing that some folks might have joined after introductions, I'm Dave Sweeter, Chief Policy Officer with the Alliance for Automotive Innovation. We're actually a trade association based in Washington, D.C., but we also have offices in Michigan, in California. We weigh in on the stuff impacting the automotive industry across all 50 states. We not only represent auto manufacturers, but we also represent tier one suppliers, battery manufacturers, tech companies, and others, including in the semiconductor space. So your question is spot on. There's no question in my mind that the industry is increasingly transitioning to electrification. You know, the ultimate question is at what pace. So I think if you pull back the shades a little bit, you know, your polling is eye-opening as it relates to just a degree of politicization that's occurring related to electrified vehicles. But they are growing. I think there's a wide recognition that they are the future. And then, of course, you know, we're going to talk through some of those challenges. But just to put it into perspective in terms of the market, I think it's important to kind of understand the landscape. Last year, EV sales accounted for just over 9.5% of all light duty sales. So again, I think that's important to keep in mind. We're at or around 15.5 million vehicles, give or take. So that gives you a sense of the new vehicle purchases. And one thing that I think oftentimes gets overlooked is as people are asked about electric vehicles or what they might mean to individual consumers is that of all registered vehicles in the United States, electric vehicles, those that are battery electric, plug-in hybrid, or fuel cell, only account for effectively 1.5% of all vehicles. So I think that's really important, both in terms of kind of where we are today and where the future is. But the investments that are being made by manufacturers and suppliers across the country are really staggering. You know, we're tracking over $125 billion of industry investments that are really helping to shape manufacturing, not just for today, but also for the future. And that obviously has a lot of impact at in states and localities in terms of jobs and the like. So hopefully that helps to give you a sense of at least where the industry is today.
Pretty much committed because it's seen as the future. And I know the competition in Asia, particularly in the PRC, is very serious about electric vehicles and they're coming. So from my point of view, part of the question here is existential. Are we going to compete in the future market or do we want to shrink and make less cars and employ less people here, which I don't think any of your members want to do. And I doubt few people do either. Albert, your organization is relentlessly bipartisan. You're on the Hill a lot, pursuing electrification across the board. How are you seeing the partisanship there? What are you running into? What's your kind of take on the way this thing has become tangled up in politics? What are the realities?
Yeah, well, thanks, Mike, for the question and for all the great data. It is illuminating. And what we see is largely the fact that we've got a wide open market for electric vehicles, a lot of potential EV customers out there that haven't had a chance to test drive one or have not had much exposure to one, and that there are some lingering attitudes that are slow to change about the technology itself, the vehicle technology itself. And so that creates a bit of a vacuum when you've got folks who haven't had a great deal of exposure to EVs and are attaching a lot of political thoughts to them. When we think of EVs, as you said, we do strive to be relentlessly bipartisan. We're nonpartisan. We function like a trade association. We share some members with the innovators. And we've got companies across the full EV supply chain from mining to battery manufacturing all the way down to EV OEMs and electric utilities. So we've got members that touch every part of the United States and for whom the value proposition of electrification that is very real and goes well beyond reducing emissions. So we see these as products that have their own really broad appeal, independent of the policy objectives that are attached to them. And, you know, we're really excited to see all these new models coming out. You know, more people having an experience with electric vehicles more similar to what you would have just, you know, viewing them alongside other new cars that are available for purchase. We're starting to see that level of variety. We're starting to see more variety in price points as well. But as we get more supply and the market starts to mature, I think that the political valence that's attached to consumer preferences or to, you know, feelings about the vehicles themselves or the drivers of EVs or the potential purchasers of EVs really start to fade away because it's not clear that there's a, you know, that there's going to be a longstanding partisan correlation with regard to these products. They're really, really fun to drive. They're safe. They're easy to refuel and getting easier. That's not to downplay the challenges that exist in building out the infrastructure. But, you know, I think where the political system interacts with some of the policy outcomes that are positive that are associated with EVs, that's where you start to see these feelings emerge. But I think we're past a really critical point in that process where, you know, the industry has been seeking certainty about, you know, what path are we on for the next you know, decade or so. And now we're just, you know, getting to work solving the challenges of EV deployment and infrastructure build out. And I think on the Hill, we see that as well, is there are lots of different reasons why people support EVs, from national security to economic development, energy security, to yes, environment, public health. And so, you know, we're now getting down to sort of a brass tacks discussion about what this means to the U.S. economy and jobs across the country.
You know, for either or both of you guys, I'm sure when the horseless carriage came around, the horse lobby put up a fight. You know, generally innovative industries have a little headwinds. I'm sure the landline phone people weren't crazy about cellular towers, you know, but this one strikes me that our politics kind of grabbed it even more aggressively than maybe the historical model of innovation. And there's a lot of misinformation out there. When you're on the Hill, and, you know, various politicians start kind of waxing on about this, how well informed are they? Because this is a fairly complicated, their national security. You're both grinning because I'll bet you've had a couple people. My first job on the Hill was an internship for a couple members, and we'd go down to the House recording studio. I'm a Georgetown student. And we'd make this little show with three congressmen interviewing each other. You know, they'd change chairs. Everybody got a half an hour show. And one day we had David Prowse there, was on a publicity tour, who was the guy inside the Darth Vader suit. That was about the biggest celebrity we could get in the original Star Wars. And afterward, one of the members, multiple term member, started asking him if anybody got hurt on the set with the laser sword, thought it was real. And that was my first eye opener about the mighty U.S. Congress. But how well do you think the policymakers in either party or both understand the technology, the challenges, and the foreign competition? Better than I think, or because I just look at the comments, they tend to be reflexively political, but not very particularly informed on the hard math numbers behind this.
It's a fair question. I think oftentimes interacting with elected officials or staffers on the Hill, you know, one of the challenges is it does become kind of a red team, blue team, or shirts versus skins type topic. But I think, you know, Albert really hit the nail on the head. I think once people are able to better understand what the technology means, then they're more inclined to give it a try. So again, this isn't the auto industry saying you must drive an electric vehicle, but let's rewind a couple decades. You know, hybrid vehicle technology was very novel, and you know, it would probably surprise a lot of people, but they've grown so accustomed to hybrid vehicles that accounted for about 10% of vehicle sales last year. So I think in many ways, because of certain challenges, whether it's geography, whether it's access to charging infrastructure, you know, EVs have generally a higher upfront cost than traditional vehicles. And we're coming off an all-time high price of vehicles because of the semiconductor chip shortage. So, you know, scarcity caused an increased price. And I think some of what you're seeing in your polling is a reflection of just the overall market. We've also seen an increase with interest rates. So, you know, if not your largest purchase or your second largest purchase in your life has implications as it relates to whether or not you might be able to afford that new product. So I think EVs kind of get viewed through that lens. But at the same time, I think politicians sometimes latch on to, well, this is, you know, only happening because of this regulation or for this reason, when in reality, I think we all can agree that there's a number of benefits. You know, Albert walked through some of them as it relates to efficiencies, you know, in terms of general operation, maintenance costs, those type of things. So when we can get beyond that, I think, you know, there's kind of a more openness to things. But it also, and I'm not making a shameless plug here, but we've got a number of great resources that break down not only vehicle sales by powertrain, but also, you know, some of these issues that we're running into in terms of charging access and public charging and those type of things. So I think as the public gets more accustomed to and sees additional powertrains like electric vehicles or fuel cell vehicles, they're more open to them. And then it ultimately comes down to a price point issue where, because of scale and cost efficiencies, I think some of the issues that are preventing EV purchases will change in the future. But again, it may or may not be for all buyers, but it's not about the industry saying, hey, you must drive an electric vehicle, whether it meets your needs or not. It's talking about some of the political lens that we're viewing it, as well as the regulatory structure. And remember, the auto industry is tremendously competitive. So the industry is always innovating. So whether it's your internal combustion engine efficiencies, whether it includes a downsize engine or a turbocharger or whatever it may be, there's a lot of innovations occurring for market share and competition. Electrification is just that next chapter. So again, I think as we ease some of these early concerns, some of it's price and affordability, some of it's the charging infrastructure, there'll be wider spread adoption. But again, at this point in time, some people project there'll be widespread adoption within 5 or 10 years. I think it might take a little bit longer because, as I said, those data streams that we show in terms of vehicle purchases and registrations by state underscore just the diversity that we have in the United States in terms of the types of vehicles that people drive, not just for commuting in a metropolitan area, but covering vast distances. I grew up out west. I'll tell you that an electric vehicle might not necessarily meet all of the needs for all purposes. So, I think that's part of the evolution that I'm talking about, and certainly defer to Albert if he's got thoughts as well.
Yeah, well, I think that was well stated. I don't think that there is anything unique about electric vehicles or charging that makes it harder for folks in Congress or on the Hill, whether members or staff, to wrap their arms around it. I think that we, particularly at the staff level, there's been a lot of interest in the exciting new technology that's come out that's made in the United States in particular. This is kind of quietly been a major success story for American innovation, American manufacturing. And we're in an age where if I don't understand something, I can go watch a 10-minute YouTube video or a 3-minute YouTube video and instantly understand it better than an hour of reading the manual would allow me to. But we've seen over the last decade or so with regard to charging and battery technology, vehicle technology, such an explosion of cool innovation, a lot of it in the EV space, some of it not exclusive to the EV space, but making its way into all new model cars. And I'll say that there's not no party's got a monopoly on misunderstanding, new technology either. We've got we're fighting a mandate to include AM radio receivers in all new vehicles, which, we're trying to make it clear to lawmakers, hey, EVs, it's not like a preference thing. It's a physics thing. It's, the motor interferes with the reception. So we bring in the signal digitally and we've never had a single complaint. But it's difficult with new technology sometimes to say, let's sit down and understand all this benefits, warts and all, et cetera, and figure out, how to take a clear-eyed look at what makes good policy. But I think that there's a really good big bipartisan lean around finding solutions. And it's been a great place to work with regard to the EV supply chain, because you've got, minerals, big battery manufacturing facilities across the United States, largely in red states, but also, also many blue states, the industrial Midwest, the Southeast, where my folks are from. Tennessee is, got making a strong case for being the sort of hub of EV manufacturing, or one of them at least. Texas, Georgia, et cetera. So, there's a really, really strong sense of community as well among these towns, cities, and towns that feel bought in to this. And I think that starts to make its way up into offices that may not be plugged into the clean air argument or the climate change argument, but are very much tuned into how this affects folks in their district or their state.
Yeah, I want to get to the job thing in a minute. I have a great infographic that David sent me I'm going to put up, but let's pretend for a minute. We're playing sci-fi make-believe. EV-powered flying saucer lands. The aliens get out and they say, okay, you guys are now in charge, not Congress. What is the best policy? Because, we have the infrastructure bill, which I was a fan of, but we've been having trouble building chargers. The money goes to the states, and a lot of the states are still thinking about it. A few, I'll give a hat tip to a Republican governor, Mike DeWine in Ohio, because he's kind of a meat and potatoes, get it done Republican, open some places. There are more starting to open, but it's been slow. I don't think we have a NEVI-funded fast charging station up and running yet in California. I have driven past a few that have been sitting for 6 months with plastic wrap on them trying to get power, which is an issue with the power utilities. So if you guys could cut through everything, what are some, what are policy things that either the government's doing right or the government ought to be doing, or at least from maybe you disagree or not, but where they're in the way a little bit? What would be your kind of elevator pitch? You had the president in the corner. The aliens have put me in charge, sir. Here's what we really need to get done.
Sure. To run through what is being done. And you're right to say that we're a couple years into the NEVI program and we're starting to see projects come online. That is necessarily a very long process. There was money granted out to states. States had to create plans with really robust stakeholder processes and send them to FHWA, get them approved. Money had to go out to states. State DOTs are administering those programs. And then you've got site selection and vendor selection. So it is, even if you've got full control, if you're a private sector developer of a DC fast charger, that is still a lengthy process just on its own before all that stuff has to happen, in the NEVI program. So I'll just say we're going to start to see projects come online at a much faster clip, but we've got over $25 billion in investment in the U.S. EV charging network to date. $10 billion of that's coming from the private sector. There are 40 U.S.-based EV charger factories that have been announced or opened in the past couple of years with a capacity to produce more than 1 million chargers a year here in the United States, including 60,000 DC fast chargers here in the U.S. We're moving forward with tax credits, the 30C tax credit that's going to help individuals and businesses install infrastructure. U.S. currently has about 180,000 charging ports, an average of 900 new chargers opening each week. Having said all that, we need to move more efficiently through this process. Some of that involves local AHJs, state DOTs, communicating with the regional FHWA and DC-based FHWA. That's happening, and that dialogue is improving at a very quick pace. The goal is 28 million charging ports, which are expected to be online by 2030. So, you can look at, NREL puts out a quarterly report showing growth in the charging network, segmented out by power level. It's really impressive to see how quickly the infrastructure is being deployed. It's not as visible, and it doesn't feel as ubiquitous as the gas station infrastructure. But the other thing I'll say for folks who own EVs, it's always surprising how much of your charging takes place at home, if you have it, where you work or where you're parked for long dwell time. So, 80% of your charging is not going to be at DC fast chargers. And there are some really, really amazing product innovations happening in the charger space for building owners, curbside charging, and the types of things that we see in countries where there's much greater levels of penetration. So a lot of work to be done there, but a lot of really, really solid reasons to feel optimistic that charging infrastructure will not be the constraint on anybody's choice to adopt an EV, at least in the aggregate. I think there are going to be some exceptions. And Dave mentioned there are some places where owning an EV won't be the best choice. But in general, we want to try to make it easy as possible.
Yeah, the home charging, the multifamily, if you can crack that, because that does make life easier. David, what would you do to straighten out government to the extent they maybe need any straightening out?
Yeah, I'd really say there's primarily three things, building on what was just mentioned. I mean, obviously, this needs to be convenient for consumers, right? I think oftentimes people forget that we've gotten accustomed to, just fueling up, and fueling up has been ubiquitous for purposes of either accessing a refueling station. I believe liquid fuels are going to be with us for quite some time. So this isn't about replacing liquid fuels. I think it's really trying to ensure that as we move forward with a host of product offerings, whether they're plug-in hybrids that operate both on gas and electric, but on the charging side, it's got to be convenient. And, Albert, you just noted something that I think is oftentimes lost on people, is that generally for the EV consumer, about 80 to 85% of the charging is happening at home or work. So really, oftentimes people are traveling less than 30 to 40 miles per day. So most electric vehicles are going to have plenty of power to get you those 40 miles. The ultimate question is, from a convenience standpoint, how can we ensure that as you're going from point A to point B, which is part of, you know, some of the federal investment, which is augmenting the private sector investment to expand the charging network. Remember, we're kind of in the early adopter stage. And I think as we make more leaps as it relates to convenient charging, that will really help. The second part, I would say, would be permitting reform. We need to be doing things not just on the mining and extracting for domestic production, but also as it relates to the stuff that, you know, Albert just mentioned, which is, you know, once states or localities are moving forward with charging infrastructure, oftentimes there's impediments or barriers that are causing that lag as it relates to some states not moving forward with their federal NEVI funding in terms of, you know, that 80-20 federal match. And then the third piece would be underscoring that out-of-pocket upfront cost for an electric vehicle might be more. You know, we haven't gotten into this just yet, but I'd say that there's a correlation between federal or state incentives and consumer uptake. So you showed on the screen earlier, there's a roughly 114 electrified vehicles for sale today, but only 22 of them qualify for the federal tax incentive up to $7,500, 13 of which are full credit, 9 of which are partial credit. So I'd say that there's a little bit of not necessarily confusion, but maybe, you know, impediments on that side until we get to the point of price parity that might be dissuading a degree of consumers who might otherwise be interested. So again, those are my three recommendations that if I was part of that landing team with that UFO, that I'd recommend.
No, it's good advice. So the aliens are listening right now. They, all right, send us Saucer to Washington. We're going to do a little Q&A to finish up. I want to go back to the screen for a minute, and I want to get to the jobs issue, because that'll lead us to the politics issue. So here we go, and this is from the Alliance. David kindly sent it to me. Here's the political story that may enter the election, because I don't think people know this. Look at that spending footprint on manufacturing jobs and supply chain, $125 billion in EV investments. And as I think both of you noted, a lot of it going to red states, or at least swing states. And I've got a chart about that. But this thing on an economic basis is really, really big. The only place that's bigger is our economic competitor, China, which has massively put government subsidies, about 7 times what we spent from basically zero to 2021. So I think most people don't understand this. I believe we have the tribal fight now of, oh, those are Biden mobiles, environmental, you're a green mobile, which is, we're the only big country where that's a polarizing argument. Most places there's consensus on climate change, but not here, reality. But if you just look at the economic argument, 10 million jobs coast to coast are connected to the, you know, the auto industry. And this is where all the action is. So I just wanted to put this up for a minute. I don't know if you each want to tag it. And then I want to get into the pure politics of the election. And will the election be good or bad for EV polarization? So if anybody, I mean, it kind of speaks for itself here. It's pretty impressive.
You're kind of to show this. I think it's a great visual, not only because it shows the reach of the auto industry, but again, you know, Eller noted, you know, whether it's Tennessee or Georgia or North Carolina or Michigan or Indiana or Ohio, the investments are absolutely staggering, which underscores something that I think is lost on folks. We can't just think about, you know, auto manufacturing or the cars that are for sale today. We've also got to think about the future. And, you know, if the U.S. wants to be competitive, you know, do we put our head in the sand and say, well, we're just not going to compete as it relates to this new powertrain? And I think the answer is a resounding no. So I think that's what we've got to move beyond. You know, there's obviously national security, energy security, geopolitical strategic benefits of ensuring that manufacturing, particularly the largest manufacturing sector in our country, is investing in the innovations that are going to lead to, you know, competition, not just among automakers in the U.S., but globally. And that means exporting vehicles that are produced in the United States as well. I think that's oftentimes overlooked. That's about 2 million vehicles today, which isn't something to sneeze at. So I'll certainly defer to you in terms of reaction to this, but I think that that's really something, regardless of party affiliation, regardless of people's background, regardless of what vehicle they may or may not want to drive, I think we could have a separate discussion or hopeful agreement that, you know, it's in the U.S.'s interest and our manufacturing sector's interest to support those innovations that are going to lead to a whole host of things, some of which we, you know, can't even contemplate today.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. I think if you imagine somebody who is sort of fuel agnostic or powertrain agnostic, but is super focused on national security, this is a project of national importance to try to move this supply chain, similar to what we've started to do with microchips. So the Chips and Science Act is investing really heavily in chip manufacturing here because of the geopolitical risk associated with the concentration of chip manufacturing in the Far East. So similarly, there's a heavy concentration of battery manufacturing, battery component manufacturing in China. But, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. They invested heavily in sites around the world to control that supply chain. I think what we're, that is a major priority for folks, like, for instance, at the NSC. And SAFE is an organization that brings together a lot of folks in the national security community to talk about the importance of that. The economic impact across the United States and moving that supply chain here, close to where the auto manufacturing itself is happening, close to where the battery manufacturing is happening, is incredibly important. And this is, I think, a contrast to, say, 15 years ago, there was an example of, you know, it's very difficult to retrain, you know, somebody who's spent decades mining coal to go install solar panels. There are examples of that happening, but it's not super easy to do, versus we have examples. Spring Hill, Tennessee is a great one here, where you've got, you know, a facility that manufactured, you know, Saturn vehicles when I was a kid, is the site of a lot of, I think, Cadillac manufacturing. Now is the site of a joint venture between LG and General Motors for a battery manufacturing facility in the same community where they've long manufactured gas vehicles. So that's happening around the country as well. These are, you know, auto manufacturing jobs that are transitioning to clean EV manufacturing jobs in the same communities and springing up in new communities in South Carolina and Georgia and Texas, just to name a few. So I think telling that story is really important. If you go down, if you go to the fuel piece of it, the electricity supply industry in the United States represents about 7 million jobs. That is an enormous industry across the entire country that is dedicated to building our electric grid, to building new generation capacity, to building cleaner sources of electricity generation. And those are really, really good local jobs in every community in the United States. And they are very aware of how they're bought into this transition and what it means to that industry, which really does affect every community across the United States. So it is a project. It's a public works project that I think those folks feel a lot of pride in. And, you know, the old story about Henry Ford wanted to build a car that his you know, employees could afford to buy on their salary. That's the challenge that we're undertaking right now. And we're in the middle of it, you know, and we're going to get there very soon. We're very close to price parity. But again, the price of a new vehicle overall is pretty high. It's higher than it was in those days. So I think that the innovation curve is really steep. The price per kilowatt hour of our batteries is coming down significantly. I think programs like the 45X production tax credit are really, really important. So communicating, I think taking it out, maybe outside of the frame of the IRA, which contains a whole lot of things other than the clean vehicle and production credits, but just saying, here, this makes us more competitive with China. This helps us to grab the reins and assert global leadership for, you know, for decades to come in battery manufacturing and vehicle manufacturing. And it is growing jobs in all of these places in the Southeast, the Midwest, the Southwest, and the places where it's already, you know, growing in California and Illinois and Georgia. So yeah, I think it's a storytelling piece, which is why I'm so happy to see you coming in to this effort as well, and bringing your expertise to bear on how to tell that story in a way that breaks through.
Yeah, I just grew up around auto plants in Detroit. We used to do the school trip. And, you know, I had a conversation with one of the big auto CEOs not long ago. And the CEO told me, China's largest auto market in the world, and it's gone electric. Now they're exporting to Latin America, and they're exporting to Europe. So if we don't get in the game to compete, which we're totally capable of doing, but it would be nice to have the home team behind us instead of silly political obstacles. If somebody calls me in 12 years for 10,000 tanks, I'm going to tell, well, I don't have any factories anymore. Call China. And that I think, is a wake-up call that's not in the equation. So here's pure politics for a minute. It is interesting that these high EV investment states in new manufacturing facilities for batteries, cars, components are also in many of the states that decide the presidential election, a real leverage point. And I don't think the voters in those states really, other than anecdotally, know this. But Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, North Carolina, and Arizona, 68% of the electoral college votes that will decide the presidency from the swing states, two-thirds, come from states with huge EV investing. And you can see it right here. And these numbers, by the way, we have to keep updating the chart. They keep growing every week. But this, I think, is the sleeper issue in the swing states. And at EV Politics, we're going to be working on it because I think it disincentivizes EV bashing. You can watch Governor Kemp in Georgia, who has won a huge lottery in investment, is careful about the rhetoric. And it's true of other Republican governors who want those jobs, too. So I think this is an issue that's going to come in to play. And it better, because we know from what we looked at before that the market penetration of EVs has to be bipartisan to get up to the numbers. You know, we have the EPA goals, and you can't get there on Democrats and some independents alone. So it's important work.
We hear about violence all the time in the news, yet we rarely hear stories about peace. There are so many people who are working hard to promote solutions to violence, toxic polarization, and authoritarianism, often at great personal risk. We never hear about these stories, but at what cost? On Making Peace Visible, we speak with journalists, storytellers, and peace builders who are on the front lines of both peace and conflict. You can find Making Peace Visible wherever you listen to podcasts.
So why don't we go wrap up with a couple of questions. First one is from Anonymous. How do U.S. electric vehicle adoption rates compare to ownership rates in other car-crazy nations? I like Anonymous. Like New Zealand, Poland, Italy, Canada, Australia, France, you know, basically Europe. Are we tracking similarly to other nations, or are we lagging globally?
I can give you a quick response. You know, China's about twice the U.S. auto market, just to give you perspective in terms of the scale. The U.S. is probably the third leading large developed market as it relates to electrification, but we're behind China, we're behind Europe. But I would note, oftentimes people say, well, why is that? I think some of it's what we've discussed today. You know, there's vast differences in the U.S. between, you know, states and other localities. So some of it is the consumer preference in terms of mobility generally. So, you know, to ensure that consumers have less of the range anxiety related to electric vehicle in the U.S., you're going to have to put maybe a larger battery pack on an electric vehicle to ensure that you've kind of corrected for that. So that's my quick reaction in terms of, you know, how the U.S. stacks up otherwise. But it's not as simple as just saying, well, this is happening in another country and they've got X percent of electric vehicle adoption. Why can't the U.S. do it? Well, there's a lot of reasons. I'll defer to you on that.
Totally right. The U.S. is a unique country geographically. And so it's difficult to compare the U.S. to, you know, a country like Norway, for instance, or China, because of the way that China's economy is organized. One graph that I like to show is by state, you know, it's a heat map of a share of new vehicle purchases that are like trucks or SUVs. And there are a staggering number of states across the country where the majority or 60 to 70% of new vehicles are in that segment. And we're just now entering a period where we've got battery electric EVs and pickup trucks available for purchase. And those costs are going to need to come down to start to penetrate those markets. I think the infrastructure piece is solvable. It's really the manufacturing piece. I mean, someone will not have considered an EV for their next purchase if there's not an electric version of the only type of vehicle they're looking for in their state or in their region. So we're still, I mean, some, I think consumer preferences may shift a bit, but we also have to meet folks where they are and deliver vehicles that meet the needs that everybody, you know, has with regard to their cars. So one thing is 5% has been shown to be a meaningful threshold after which there's a social proof effect. People would much rather talk to their neighbor than listen to me or us talk about why they should consider an EV because they'll get an unvarnished look at it. And we see that with rooftop solar and a lot of other things too.
All right. We got very little time left. We're going to do a lightning round here. Somebody wants to know, when will the U.S. Postal Service replace their postal delivery trucks with EVs? I know the Canadians are doing it with American-made Rivians. Do we know? Has there been discussion of that? Any quick answers? My guess is there's discussion. The Postal Service is generally under financial pressure. So
But it is. There was a significant amount of effort that went into that, and it is underway. I'll put it that way. A lot of the hard work has been done. It's really the implementation that's underway now.
Another question. Are any state or federal rebates set to expire? That's one part of the question. And the second is kind of the other argument. Are those just giving rich people a discount, people who can afford EVs anyway? What's the quick take on the rebates? Are they going to stick around? And that argument about they're subsidizing wealthy EV buyers.
Sure. Mike, I guess in terms of federal or state incentives, they fluctuate. So at the federal level, I talked about the federal tax credit, which you know only 22 vehicles currently qualify. So those already include some degree of means testing in terms of the price of the vehicle or the income of the buyer. So I think that addresses maybe that question, at least at the federal incentive level. Now, at the state level, we see a direct correlation with states that have additional EV purchase incentives or plug-in hybrid purchase incentives, but those can fluctuate depending on state budgets. So again, it can ebb and flow depending on the resources the states have in place. But when there are incentives, we see a higher saturation or a higher uptake as it relates to electrification. And, you know, the secret sauce would be a combination of a federal qualified vehicle eligibility from a tax incentive along with a state local incentive. And remember, the average age of a vehicle is growing and it's a little over 12 years old. So, you know, those incentives really can help in certain markets.
And EV prices are going down. I think that the average delta is down to like 5,000 from a lot more. All right. This is an interesting question. I'm not sure we know the answer. If anybody does, it'll be David, or maybe Albert will surprise me. I don't know the answer, but David wants to know what percentage of EV owners buy a second one versus going back to internal combustion? Everybody I know with an EV is pretty nuts for it, but I wonder if there's market data on it.
I have seen some market data. It's fluctuated. I saw some stuff a couple years ago. Generally, I guess one of the challenges is understanding the market, right? So for an EV owner today to have that question, are they going back to EV? Are they going into plug-in hybrid or internal combustion? In the past, before there was a lot of advances, some people were not making that decision to go back to electric vehicles. But as Albert noted, there's been so many improvements from first generation to what we're experiencing today. It's not by accident that there's over 114 models available for consumers to choose from. So I think some of that was early indicators that have now proven themselves to not necessarily be the case.
Gotcha. Pierce wants to know, this will be our last question. And again, I apologize, but we got to get to it quick. How likely soon could industry change direction considering their massive investments if federal support changed direction? Wondering about the sustainability of, I think, the subsidies given the natural resources and human rights concerned associated. That's a mining question, rare earth materials. So basically, are the companies going to do a U-turn after an election if something happens, or are we on this road to stay?
I'll say our members are certainly on this road to stay. I think, and from what I see of the broader industry, I think the scale of the investments made are so significant, and the results clear. And some of the challenges emerging in manufacturing and things are highly solvable. So I think, from our view, we're fully committed to moving forward, but Dave, I'll let you speak for the broader industry.
Yeah. I'd say there's no question that electrification is the future. The question is at what pace. The questioner asked a good one, which is, you know, what happens if certain incentives that have maybe helped support some of that record multi-billion-dollar investment were to, you know, be curtailed or go away? I would maybe turn the question around and say, well, we'd need to better understand what's being proposed. Because, Mike, I think that map you showed, not just the battleground states, not just the investments that are being made across the country, regardless of red state, blue state, underscore something that, you know, is a bipartisan issue, which is investments that create U.S. jobs are a winner, period. So I think that's the lens that some of this needs to be looked at. And until we get to a point, should there be changes in election, we can't really answer that. And Mike, just in closing, one of the things that I think is oftentimes forgotten is some of the political stigma that's showing up, I think, in your polling is a direct reflection of maybe what people perceive as it relates to federal regulations or state regulations or viewing that EVs are being mandated. Well, at this point, it's no longer a question if manufacturers are committed to electrifications. It's at what pace. But the regulations are in many ways pulling the industry in a particular direction for a variety of reasons. But again, ultimately, the consumer and the market are going to be the deciding factor. And that's where we can't squander this opportunity. These investments weren't made by accident. These investments were made to last multi-decades. So at this point, I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. Final lightning one-word answer question. Unless, Albert, you got
something. I just wanted to comment, Dave, on that answer. And also, I think the final EPA rule, you know, as you said, sort of demolished any argument that there's a mandate for EVs. I think it's very clear there's a mandate to cut tailpipe pollution in half over the next 8 years, which everybody supports. And it's going to be led by consumers and their choices. And demand is going to dictate what technology manufacturers opt into. Our job as within Zeta is to go out and make this EV supply chain, battery supply chain infrastructure work as well as we know it can. And that's why we believe that, you know, BEVs are going to be a really big piece of that puzzle. But, you know, I think, you know, anybody who's out there saying there's a mandate, is out of date with their talking points.
No, it's a scary monster, but it's not really that accurate. Okay, I want to thank Albert Gorf from Zeta, my favorite name, the Zero Emissions Transport Organization. They put out a lot of stuff, including a cool weekly email newsletter. You can Google them and check it out. Also from the Alliance for Automotive Innovation. See, I got it right. They put out incredible data on their website. And finally, if you're a fanatic for this stuff because you care about American jobs, and you like driving a fast car, low maintenance, and not paying at the pump here in California, you know what I'm talking about. Check out evpolitics.org. You can even get a cool bumper sticker and a coffee mug with one of our snappy items in the merch store. So thank you all. I want to finish with a plug for us, the Center for the Political Future. If you want to know about these Zooms, and we do a lot of them, and our on-campus programming, we have a newsletter. All you got to do is sign up. So just go to our website, the USC Center for the Political Future, or if you've got a photographic memory, you can go to signup.e2ma.net/signup/a-lot-of-numbers. I won't even try. Just go online, get our newsletter. It's great. And finally, if you want to support our work, we raise money to do that. Check it out. Again, at our website, we have the Center Leadership Circles, lots of levels, where you can give and help us with the internships on campus. We put a lot of kids out into the real world to learn stuff. And all the work we do at the Center for the Political Future on less partisanship, less polarization, more disagreeing agreeably with a common set of facts. So I want to thank my guests. I want to thank you for watching. And when in doubt, drive electric.
Thank you for joining us on The Bully Pulpit. It helps us a lot when you subscribe and rate the show 5 stars wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at @USCPOLFuture. That's @USCPOLFuture. Follow us on Facebook and YouTube and visit our website for upcoming programs.
This podcast is part of the Democracy Group.